Welcome to this podcast series from Academic Impressions titled Rethinking the Role of Service in Promotion and Tenure, Defining It, Measuring It, and Addressing Inequities. This is the third podcast of a three-part series that will bring together examples of innovative and evolving thinking and practices around service and personnel reviews, both at the unit and central levels, with the aim of helping to transform existing structures and policies. Today, we will focus on addressing inequities in the process. My name is Alicia Miranda, and I lead our faculty success work at Academic Impressions. In this podcast, Donna Garcia, Director of the Diversity, Equity, and Promotion Hiring and Tenure Center at California State University, San Bernardino, will lead the conversation on how to infuse equity into the process of rethinking service and promotion and tenure. We will discuss the importance of understanding the inequities that exist and the impact that they have on faculty and the institution, the importance of ensuring that the evidence for what constitutes service and how it is measured is consistent, and how to use clear guidelines and address inconsistencies in judgment of reviewers of service. As part of this podcast, you will be able to download accompanying resources that have been mentioned throughout. Hi, Donna. I'm so lucky to have you joining me today.
Thanks so much, Alicia. I am excited about being here and actually honored to be part of this wonderful podcast.
Thank you, Donna. I want to start with, if you're able to tell me a little bit about the work that you do in the Depth Center, how did it come about, and how is it addressing the shifts that we're seeing right now in promotion, hiring, and tenure in higher ed?
Thanks for that question, Alicia. I'm going to start with how the Diversity and Equity and Promotion Tenure and Hiring, or Depth Center, as we call it, the initiative itself came about at CSUSB. We began in 2017 as a collaborative effort between faculty, three faculty members, the Assistant Director of Diversity Initiatives in our Office of Faculty Affairs, and our Provost. So we had folks from two faculty-centered offices and the faculty body. Our collaboration was in response to two primary legitimate concerns we were hearing on our campus at that time. This is back again in 2017. One of the concerns was coming from faculty, administrators, and students alike, that our campus lacked faculty diversity. And that was a big issue at CSUSB because we are an HSI, a Hispanic serving institution, and the majority of our students came from underserved ethnic and economic backgrounds. A second growing number concern was coming from faculty who raised issues about equity in hiring packages and in the promotion and tenure, or P&T, outcomes, and both in the decisions made at P&T and the salary increases that were granted. In response to these concerns, our collaborative did some investigation. We convened a task force, and I'll talk a little bit more about the investigation we did later. What's important now is that what we did was identify several inequities, as well as opportunities for biases to be expressed in both our hiring and promotion and tenure outcomes and practices. So we took this information that we had gathered and we leveraged these results to write three grant proposals, which we were fortunate to have all funded. Two were sizable grants, around $155,000 together from our chancellor's office, which oversees all 23 of the CSU campuses, and an NSF advanced adaptation grant that we received in 2018 for approximately $1 million. Together, this funding supported the creation of the Depth Center. And from that center, the Depth team, which again, I want to emphasize is a collaborative effort between faculty, faculty affairs, and academic affairs, because I feel this is a really important piece of our success. So together, we developed evidence-based approaches to advance faculty diversity, equity, and inclusion on our campus. Now, I'm going to note that when I'm talking about evidence-based, I mean both in terms of the practices and the policies. We used practices and policies and taught them to faculty that were empirically shown to increase DEI in hiring and faculty evaluation. But what's important here is the initiatives that we ran, so the training programs, et cetera, were also grounded in empirical research in terms of successful behavior change. And we focused all our efforts on both the institution and the individuals within the institution. This type of multi-prong approach to DEI is one of the shifts we are seeing across the institutions right now. The shift has really moved in the approach from focusing on changing the practice and behaviors and beliefs of individuals to now also addressing the biases and inequities that are woven into the fabric of the institution. Its culture, its policies, its practices, and consequently become embedded into everyday operations. Another shift I believe we are seeing is an increased recognition of the continuity between the hiring and the evaluation process. Often, focus has been on one or the other, without always integrating them together. But if broad and active recruiting approaches are used to increase the size and diversity of applicant pools and the likelihood of hiring faculty from diverse backgrounds, these approaches then also need to be incorporated in the promotion and tenure processes. For example, the criteria used for recruiting and hiring new faculty should correspond with how those faculty will be evaluated. If broad criteria were used to expand the search, then those broad criteria need to be part of P&T decisions as well. I'll come back to that strategy later in our conversation. I want to conclude this question with the acknowledgement that after several years of focusing on DEI and hiring mentoring, another shift that's occurring is that many institutions are now doing great work at assessing how they make promotion and tenure decisions, including how service is evaluated and valued.
Thank you, Donna. That overview is really helpful. And I'm also really excited to hear more of the details of the work that you all are doing. So in that spirit, I understand that before you address inequities, you first need to understand what the inequities are and how they impact faculty and their career progression and who is most impacted. How did you all go about doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think first I'll talk about what we did, but I want to point out that in general, institutions, of course, differ from one another. But I think in how they gather data, there's going to be differences. But I think what our approach does provide is a template of using multiple approaches to gather as much information as possible. In response to the concerns raised about the lack of faculty, diversity, equity, and inclusion, the DEPTH team initially surveyed faculty about their work experiences. For example, we asked about workload, work distribution, that is the percentage of time spent on research, teaching, service, other activities. We asked about both departmental and institutional climate, turnover intentions, the feelings of faculty in terms of being appreciated and respected, their perceptions of appropriateness, consistency, fairness, and equity in the promotion and tenure process. We also included open-ended questions that allowed faculty to expand on their experiences or share information we hadn't specifically captured in their survey questions. We then analyzed the quantitative and open-ended responses by gender, race, ethnicity, and field, whether it was STEM or non-STEM fields the faculty were in, and the intersection of those three, so gender, race, ethnicity, and field. We also gathered a lot of data from our institutional research office and academic affairs offices. For example, we gathered salary information of our faculty, release time and startup at hiring, and the hiring patterns over time, as in we looked at the demographics of who was hired over a five-year period. We also gathered information about tenure outcomes. For example, we looked at the time between associate and full professor, the number of faculty who were in each rank within our STEM and non-STEM departments. We then again analyzed also by gender and race ethnicity. We also documented the demographics of faculty who served on our faculty search and evaluation committees. Again, we tracked this information for 5 years. We did it in the past, and then we did it for the 5 years over the DEPTH initiatives. And this information tracking is now institutionalized at CSUSB with a focus on the pattern of inequities. And I say that because I always get asked about, sure, startups going to differ, but that could be just because people are doing different work. You would expect that to be true at specific times, but not consistently over time. So if you see gender differences in startup over time, there's likely a problem. We also conducted focus groups with faculty. We separated them by college, and then we split them into probationary versus senior faculty, one because they have different experiences, but we also wanted to ensure junior faculty had a safe, or probationary faculty had a safe space to speak openly. The central conversation of our focus groups was on tenure and promotion experiences, both from the perspective of the evaluators, so members of a promotion and tenure committee, and as the candidate being evaluated. We also surveyed faculty every other year about their experiences serving on search and evaluation committees, so being part of recruiting and evaluating peers. We did this other initiative that I actually was really excited about and I think was great, and we got wonderful information from. We surveyed all finalists who interviewed for a faculty position. We not only learned a lot about their experiences during the recruitment and interview process, but we also gained some really valuable insights into their perceptions about our promotion and tenure criteria and practices. In addition to collecting data, we did content analyses of faculty hiring and evaluation policies and the websites for faculty affairs and academic affairs. We looked for cues of inclusive language versus non-inclusive language, and information that could convey differing values across different identities. Overall, we took and continue to take a very information-centered approach and have been dedicated to giving our faculty a voice. And central to the theme of this podcast, we observed that promotion and tenure outcomes for faculty from historically underrepresented gender and racial ethnic groups were less positive relative to those from historically well-represented groups. Women, especially women of color, were less likely to get tenure and promotion to assistant professor early, spent longer time at associate professor, and receive lower salary increases relative to their male counterparts. As you probably know, Alicia, this pattern is not unique to CSUSB. Great work by scholars such as Joy Misra, Dana Britton, Carrie Ann O'Meara, Gardner and Blackstone, Amy Blackstone is at Maine, Fox and Colatrella have identified similar issues in other institutions. One common denominator also noticed by scholars across institution is the pattern that members of marginalized groups tend to devote more time to service, and service is not highly valued in the promotion and tenure process in comparison to scholarship, research, creative activities, etc. I tend to use the term the umbrella term scholarship for all those activities.
It's impressive, Donna, to hear the data-informed approach that you all have taken. And I can only imagine how powerful having all of that data and that insight into contributing to the work that you all are doing. I can imagine how powerful that is. So with that understanding, I'd love to move us to the topic of standards. And it seems like transparent and consistent standards as to what constitutes service really gets to the heart of the issue. Tell us about how what you have done and what you've learned that can inform how other institutions start to achieve that as well.
Okay, well, first, you're absolutely right about the necessity for transparent and consistent standards for service as well as scholarship teaching, etc. In 2000, the AAUP, American Association for University Professors, published a paper on good practices in tenure evaluation, in which they discussed or proposed the four C's: clarity, consistency, candor, and caring. I think this is a great paper and it's a good starting point for people who are interested in reevaluating their P&T processes. But it's a 2000 paper and we've come some way since then. I'm going to focus on the first two C's in that paper plus transparency, because faculty with marginalized identities, for example, but not limited to women, other gender minorities, faculty of color, are less likely to perceive the P&T processes as transparent, clear, and consistent than their marginalized counterparts. Just a note that I did include the references on the resource sheet that I provided with this podcast. I want to note that there is a large literature first, before I continue, that comes from fields such as management, industrial, and organizational psychology and organizational behavior that identifies best practices in performance appraisal, many of which can be applied to faculty evaluation and review. I mention that literature because although I don't have time for a synopsis of it, it's a very large body of literature, I want to emphasize that there is a common theme throughout the literature that accurate and fair performance assessment requires transparency, clarity, and consistency. I think we should chat, if you don't mind, Alicia, a moment about what is meant by those terms. So what does transparency mean and how does it relate to service? First of all the expectations for promotion and tenure need to be known by those who will conduct the faculty evaluations and reviews and by those who will be evaluated and reviewed. These expectations need to be openly discussed and explicitly articulated in the promotion and tenure guidelines. There needs to be open dialogue at the department or the unit level about the role of performance management versus performance evaluation and how these might differ at different career stages. Performance management is that information that's provided to probationary faculty via helps them know whether they're on track for promotion and tenure. It's also the information that's provided to associate professors to let them know, are you on track in terms of the activities you're engaged in, your outputs, your accomplishments for full professor? Evaluations, performance evaluation, of course, is the assessment of whether the peer probationary faculty should be retained, so retention, and then promoted and tenured. But both of those pieces have an important part in faculty evaluation. And we need to discuss that. So that information is weighted appropriately and to ensure that we keep probationary faculty and then associate professors on track to their next career marker. So there needs to be open discussion. Just like with everything, there needs to be open discussion about service expectations, what service is needed in the department, and how that service is valuable for the department, the college, programs, et cetera, to operate optimally. Service is often just talked about. I know in my experience, is a student, as a graduate student, and then as an early faculty member. Service was somewhat dismissed from conversations with a focus on scholarship and then teaching. So what I'm pointing out here is that conveyed value about service. And I think that rather than it being implicitly this kind of devaluing, we need to discuss it openly, why it is valuable to the university. We need to discuss assumptions about the value of service and acknowledge who carries the service load in the department, college, or other unit. Bill Eggington, who publishes on performance appraisal in academic contexts, argues that transparency requires not only shared knowledge about common standards and criteria, so the expectations that will be applied to all individuals, but there also needs to be a common understanding, conversation about how flexibility can be built into the P&T process in a fair way that can address faculty on an individual basis when necessary. For example, when a faculty member engages in extraordinary service that's essential to the unit's optimal functioning, there needs to be an understanding how that's treated. If that service work interferes with the time availability to do scholarship or teaching. Now, I'm going to move to clarity, which I kind of see as a first cousin or maybe even a sibling to transparency. Clarity of behavior, activities, quantity, results, outputs, quality, priorities, timeline, and how these things are weighted for P&T are all necessary. What are the service expectations for pre-tenure and post-tenure faculty? And I can tell you, this does vary across institution, even though a lot of us come with a common understanding about how faculty's time is protected from service in the first years. That's not true across all institutions in terms of their expectations. So there should be a conversation. And there needs to be a conversation about service expectations at different career stages for pre-tenure, for example, and post-tenure faculty for a promotion to associate versus full professor. This information has to be clear and, again, transparent. We also need to have clarity then in how the service will be evaluated, how service will be weighted. For example, will multiple service activities outputs be evaluated the same as a single time consuming activity, such as serving on a search committee? Are they weighted differently based on their value to the academic unit, their time commitment, their output? I'm not saying which one is best here, but there needs to be agreement, because that is the start. That type of conversation starts towards the understanding of the value of service as well. There also needs to, how is service evaluated if the service activity is accompanied by release time or stipends, or doesn't require much time commitment? Another point I want to raise, I think this is a big one, that I've seen myself in the evaluations of faculty, as well as I've seen some work on it outside of the university, where Monica Bernat's shifting standard model has been applied to the context of faculty evaluations. And what that refers to is there is a tendency for the subjective language that's used in evaluations to not necessarily translate to objective outcomes. So what do I mean by that? Is women and faculty from other marginalized identities will often get really super positive feedback in terms of the subjective narrative
lots of praise.
But when it comes to the outcome that relates to their employment, whether they got promoted early, tenured early, promoted and tenured, or when they get promoted to full, and what salary increase accompanies their promotion, doesn't always match the positivity of the subjective language. So there needs to be conversations, awareness of that, looking at what subjective language, what positive adjectives are used in the guidelines, and ensure that those adjectives are applied consistent with the outcomes that are specified in the guidelines. Clarity is important because when standards are ambiguous, biases are more likely to manifest. And consistency. I think of consistency as being the extent to which the composition of the committee or features of the target of evaluation that are unrelated to their actual performance unlikely affects the promotion and tenure outcomes. If standards are transparent and clear, there should be a reasonable degree of consistency across the various levels of review. For example, at CSUSB, we have a department evaluation committee, a department chair, the dean, and a college evaluation committee all assess the candidate who is up for promotion and or tenure. So you would expect, though, the reason you have those multiple levels is a corrective measure. It's to ensure fairness. But you still should see a degree of consistency in the decisions that come from the different levels. There should also be consistencies across candidates from the same reviewer. So that is, any given evaluator should be giving similar ratings to others for similar outputs. Consistency to some degree is a measure of equity. Patterns of inconsistencies across demographic groups is often an indicator of biases and inequitable treatment. And service in itself, it provides an interesting challenge to what I'm saying about the importance of consistency, because there are clear and well-documented differences in who does the bulk of service and who is willing to do the less valued, the less visible, or even invisible and devalued service. So again, there needs to be conversation, acknowledgement about this issue, and discussion on how it can be addressed. So in summary, the promotion and tenure process, what I'm saying was that transparency, clarity, and consistency would mean that the process won't end up being what Eugene Rice in 1996 coined as archery in the dark.
It's so helpful to hear you, Donna, articulate notions such as transparency and clarity and how those relate to performance management and effective evaluation. And it's also helpful to hear that articulated at both a larger scale and at a more granular one, especially when you think about subjective language and adjectives. That's probably not something many who are thinking about this topic have thought about. And so it's very interesting to see both sides of that. And I think what you're describing really moves us on to the next question well, where the notions of transparency and clarity get us to the question of guidelines. Tell us what those could look like in this process.
Well, they should, of course, reflect transparency, clarity, consistency, and I'll also add candor. And it should involve full departments in their development. When you have all members of a unit involved, where they're actively engaged in the decision-making, they are more likely to come to stakeholder acceptance. That is, they're more likely to accept the decisions that are made and integrate them into their practice. The guidelines should provide faculty with what I would say would be somewhat of a template that guides them into knowing. So for faculty who are going under review, this template that guides them into knowing what outputs, activities, and accomplishments should go into their promotion and or tenure portfolios? What section, where should these activities outputs be placed? Example, I have seen mentoring under research, I've seen it under teaching, and I've seen it under service, and it's hard to evaluate it consistently when it's placed in different spots in a portfolio. So that information should be provided in the guidelines. So there's clarity of what information, where it goes, and also what supportive documentation or evidence is needed. The guidelines need to encourage portfolios that are comprehensive enough to represent the full range of candidates' accomplishments and activities. But at the same time, the guidelines need to discourage the inclusion of extraneous information that doesn't really and shouldn't really, or should I say shouldn't really, influence decisions. Again, it goes back to this issue of consistency. Inconsistency in what types of information is included can introduce biases, because one might not always evaluate the information. Sometimes some people might dismiss it and say this is unnecessary, where others might pay attention to it and use it in the evaluation as somewhat of a padding of those they like, leading to inconsistencies of judgments. Also, extra information. And this is a thing that I've noticed in at least my university system and my campus, is the tendency to include a lot of information just in case, everything I've done. But that makes it really difficult to be able to review that information in an accurate way, because when there's so much information, it adds time burden and cognitive load, both of which are known, by the way, to introduce biases into decision-making. Really good guidelines should also be, should be able to essentially serve as a rubric in a way. I should be able to look at those guidelines, look at the portfolio, and what in my institution we call the Faculty Activity Report, the FAR, look at it, the CV, and line it up to the guidelines in a way that it's easy to review and evaluate a large number, because sometimes in departments like mine with over 30 that had over 30 faculty members, it can be a lot of work when you're on those committees. I think of the guidelines used by Humboldt State University's psychology department is a great example, particularly their research and scholarship guidelines. Their service guidelines are also good, but not as comprehensive as their scholarship ones. And not everyone will like their guidelines for scholarship because they are very numerically based. But they are a great example of how transparency, clarity, and consistency can be achieved in guidelines.
So Donna, I know you've talked a little bit already about inconsistencies and bias from reviewers, but I want to dig into that a little deeper. You've articulated that inconsistencies stem from unequal service burden. We've talked at length about that, but we also know that it stems from inconsistencies and bias from the reviewers themselves. What recommendations do you have to address that, to help with that?
Okay, I think that I'm going to break this question or my answer into kind of two sections. One is, you asked about what can individuals do. Am I correct in my interpretation of your question?
Yeah, I think we can certainly look at it from that level.
Okay, well, one is for individuals to be aware that biases can manifest inadvertently, unconsciously, automatically. I know there's been a lot of conversation about unconscious bias, and there's been unconscious bias training, which in on their own are not sufficient to produce any type of change, long-term change. But it might be a necessary step is first learning about it and understanding it. And knowing that very often the people, in fact, there is a correlation between people's perceptions that they are objective in their judgment making, they're also the individuals who are more likely to show implicit bias in judgment making. So we're not good, well, judges of ourselves, our own biases. So learning about that, acknowledging that, and then engaging in strategies, and there's many out there. I'll include a resource sheet that gives some really great tips that I have found that are evidence-based. But one example would be, before you're conducting a review, before you're evaluating a faculty member, you need to be cognizant of your overall context, the space that you're in, as well as your mental space. We're more likely to exhibit biases when we are in a high emotional state, so sad, angry, even happy. So try to get into a neutral space. Some people can do mindfulness practices, meditation, just deep yoga breaths, but try to get into this nice neutral calm space. Opening the file and being in a place where you have time. Because if you are constantly interrupted, turn off your emails, for example. Shut the office door. Try to reduce, minimize interruptions, and you can't always control for it. But being in a time and a space where you have minimal interruptions reduces cognitive load. Reduces, again, the likelihood that you'll resort to bias, that bias will enter into the decisions. Make notes so that if there are interruptions, you can return to the where you were at accurately, because often what we remember past can be influenced by the new information that we encounter when there's been a gap between those two spaces of information. Also be aware that your first reaction to a file can influence your perceptions throughout it. So again, taking notes and forcing accountability. Simply thinking, why did I come to that judgment? Is that judgment the same that I would do for another person with similar outputs, qualifications? So do some self-accountability. And again, now I mentioned about cognitive load and interruption, also reduce noise. Be in a pleasant environment. So environment matters a great deal. Another thing that I want to talk about, Alicia, if I may, is to more at the institutional level as well, or the collective level. Again, I mentioned earlier, we need to have open and honest conversation about service, but we also have to have it in a way that all faculty voices can be heard. And there's a certain amount of safety to probationary faculty and faculty from marginalized groups, so that they feel comfortable in speaking their truth, right, about their experience. We need to talk about what service constitutes. Its importance in leadership development is value to the institution and the shared governance process, which is a basic tenet of college governance, and it's essential to the optimal functioning of higher ed. We know that academic freedom is an essential tenet. And I think most faculty or academics could talk about that cogently without a problem on why that's important. Shared governance is also a central tenet, but doesn't have that type of narrative conversation behind it. As Robert Maynard Hutchins said in his seminal book, Higher Learning in America, 1936, we get the best results in education and research if we leave their management to people who know something about them. Indeed. Now, Alicia, faculty have special training and expertise that qualifies them to make decisions in their areas and to judge the effectiveness and competence of their faculty peers. They are the best evaluators, reviewers in the RPT or the promotion and tenure process. We also have to have conversations about who gets asked to do service. Why are they asked? What service activities are specific groups of people asked to do? How are those activities rewarded? Or more importantly, who gets rewarded for service with things like release time, stipends, acknowledgement and promotion and tenure, or salary increases? We know that, and the reason I point this out is something that's quite common knowledge right now. The notion of cultural taxation, identity taxation, as well as service load differences across groups of faculty from different identity groups. Cultural taxation was originally coined by Amado Padilla, I think, in 1994, and then expanded in 2012 by Hirschfield and Joseph to identity taxation. The realization that faculty are often asked to take an extra burden of service responsibilities when they are also from marginalized groups. They get asked to essentially serve as the voice of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, I can see the benefits of this. We don't want a group of white, straight, cisgendered men always speaking for DEI. Of course, we want diversity in that voice. The problem is just tacking someone in there for the sake of appearance is tokenism and adds cultural taxation to that person. Another issue with service is that people with marginalized identities often find it difficult to say no. So when they're asked, they're more likely to say yes. One problem with that is people tend to ask individuals who say yes if they'll do service. So they're asked to do more. At my institution, I had one of our administrative support personnel hang a great big sign up in my office that had the letters N-O on it. Because from my background, I'm a Hispanic Italian woman from a low-income family. I was taught to avoid saying no. I still now have problems. I skirt around it. I try to find other ways. No, instead of saying no, I don't want to do that, I'll say, oh, I'd like to, but I think I'm busy, right? I hedge. So there is that issue. And recognizing this, acknowledging this, and that there is a certain amount of exploitation that occurs of that tendency among certain groups of people. What's important too is realizing, as Joy Misra from UMass and her work, she talks about how research indicates that service requests to faculty who tend to be overburdened with service don't just come from supervisors, but it also comes from colleagues and students. Another thing that I haven't heard conversation about, but I want to explore more, is the extent to which people are asked to do service activities that match their social value. There's different valuing of people. I've been using the term marginalized. Marginalized implies lower value. Are people who are valued less more likely to be asked to do service activities that aren't also highly valued? And one other thing I want to mention about service, there's also a good reason why people with marginalized identities want to often pursue more service. It's not just because they're asked to do it. They can't say no. It's also because people with lower status identities tend to gravitate towards hierarchy attenuating occupations. There's this lot of work done by Felicia Prado and Jim Sedanius on social dominance theory or social dominance orientation as part of that theory. And so there's a tendency for example, women and people of color to gravitate towards occupations that allow them to break down hierarchies. Within academia, there's also activities or service roles that can be taken on that allow people to reach that goal as well, right? So often you're going to see women and people of color and people from other marginalized identities with disabilities, sexual minorities, etc., enter service roles so they can initiate real change within their institution. So I'm just going to say that scholarship is a coordinated effort. We really, really prioritize scholarship in the academy. Research, scholarship, creative activities, they are the gold. They're golden. Knowledge production. But it's a coordinated effort. I recognize that when people think of collaboration and coordinated scholarship, their minds probably center on the generation and testing of ideas, the collaborative efforts, and the dissemination of knowledge. But much effort, what I mean, is that much effort or service work goes into providing the context to facilitate quality scholarship and to take care of the many other operations in running a college, to free up those who want to produce knowledge, to want to engage in scholarship, to free up their time so they can do good quality scholarship. In a way, it's like households where an adult partner or multiple adult partners stay home to care for the family and house so the others can go home and maximize earning potential. Someone has to do the work that makes it possible for scholarship to occur. So I think then there needs to be, and I've mentioned this several times, and I just think it's so important to have a concerted effort to change how service is understood. The institutional rhetoric around service needs to change, and the incongruence between the reward systems and what faculty actually do. We need to increase awareness of how service is conveyed. Often, I was taught when I was a student that it was a necessary evil that interferes with real academic work, that being scholarship. And that's a common understanding. I don't mean to call anyone out on that. That's a common understanding. The emphasis on scholarship to the detriment of teaching and service and promotion and tenure decisions is actually a major source of stress and dissatisfaction for probationary faculty. There's work by Rice et al. 2000 and others that show this problem. It's also, this emphasis on scholarship is also inconsistent with many academics' reality. And I really wanted to get to this point because according to the National Center for Education Statistics, NCES, there were approximately 4,000 degree-granting institutions in the US in 2021. Although the majority of faculty being hired by those institutions were trained in very high or high research activity universities, that is R1s and R2s, approximately 300 higher educations in the USA actually have those Carnegie classifications. Okay. So despite being trained for scholarship productivity, the majority of faculty are employed in two-year institutions or four-year institutions that stress a combination of teaching and service and often offer limited resources, time, funding for scholarship production. So as noted by Taraski and Gonzalez, they've done some great work. A large percentage of new faculty members face incongruence between their graduate school preparation, their academic appointment, and their employing institution. One approach I've seen, and I do want to just put out a caution there, is that there have been efforts, and I think the efforts have been great to some degree, to encompass service into scholarship. I can see why incorporating service under the umbrella of scholarship can be useful in some instances. But I also am concerned that the relabeling for the purpose of giving service new value could be counterproductive and support narratives that service is not valuable in and of itself. So summing up, expansive understandings of service, including DEI service work, needs to be described and rewarded in P&T guidelines, and that takes conversation. Also, I wanted to note before I close this question, two great resources are Larson and Austin's 2020 book, Building Gender Equity in the Academy, and Stewart and Valiant's book, An Inclusive Academy. Both these books provide some really great insights into what I call the service dilemma and how it can be addressed.
Thank you, Donna, for such a comprehensive answer to this. And I so appreciate that you've brought the social aspect of this to the forefront of the conversation. I can imagine that it's easy to get caught up in policies and procedures and forget to talk about the marginalized identities and social identities of the people we're really helping to try and create equity for. So I appreciate that. Thank you. And I'd love to ask you now, if you were to take stock of what you've learned so far and what you envision doing in the future, could you share what you perceive to be initial challenges you've encountered, initial outcomes, and maybe successes of the work you've done so far?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question, Licia. And I'll say that some of the challenges are simply that when you're trying to redefine promotion and tenure standards, the criteria, expectations, and they've been so grounded in the academy for centuries, essentially, right? It's difficult to get people to see that inherently scholarship doesn't have to be valued to the extent it is relative to teaching and service. It's important. I'm not trying to suggest it's not important. It's the proportionate valuing, how different that is in understanding that we're in a changing world and institutions have changed, and that we can't bring what could be called trickle down our one understandings into all institutions, that it doesn't really work. So I think it's difficult getting people to see beyond what has worked, or at least they think has worked for them and for others. In terms of the RPT process, one approach that we used that I found beneficial, and unfortunately we realized this in our fourth and last year, the grant, was to conduct faculty learning communities. We had FLCs set up by departments and had them work. We met together, we talked to it, we had specified readings, a lot dealing with biases in assessing research or being able to conduct research, inequities that lead to different research outputs, same thing for teaching and service. And then they went back with the information they gained and created new guidelines with their department, which then they again brought back to the FLC and they exchanged with other departments to test their guidelines to see if they met the standards of consistency, clarity, transparency, et cetera. That turned out to be a great approach. And if I were to be able to do this all over again, I would start that way with hiring as well as with promotion and tenure, to do it in faculty learning communities. Okay. I'm hoping now, you asked me, I think, too, about what I hope to see in the future. I'm hoping to see more large-scale attention paid to service, as there is to research and teaching. For example, I would love to see the equivalent to DORA and TERRA. DORA is the Declaration on Research Assessment that I believe comes from the University of San Francisco. It's a collaborative effort across other institutions on redefining how we assess research, so we do so in a more equitable and accurate way. TERRA is the toolbox for this research assessment. It would be great to see that we also put emphasis on teaching and service similarly. NSF Advance is an absolutely wonderful program, and I can't speak again how great they are. And a lot of scholars with Advanced grants are now doing work related more to promotion and tenure, including focus on service. That's great. Like to see more. I look forward to seeing more publications on it. And I think there needs to be large-scale changes in the academy in how students are actually prepared for academic positions. We need to look beyond training them all to go to an R1 or an R2, because the odds are not that is their progression. Okay. And finally, I just want to say that service requires support and resources. If we want people to do support, we not only have a service, we not only have to value it, we have to support in the resources. And we need to see more open discussion like this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to see that as well. You've done a wonderful job throughout this podcast, Donna, of mentioning others who do similar related work and who are thinking differently about this as well. Is there anyone else you would add in terms of who else others might draw inspiration from for their work around addressing equity in the process?
Yes, thank you for asking that question. I love acknowledging the great work I'm seeing out there. I can't cover all of it, so I'm just going to focus on a few that are kind of in my immediate mind at the moment. One is the University of West Virginia. They've been doing work on changing promotion and tenure guidelines, so that they, and now their focus has been on expanding the path to professor, so to full professor from associate, to account for extraordinary service or outstanding contributions in any specific area. So they're looking at how do we redefine the process from associate to full in a way that accommodates those individuals who are doing this extraordinary service work. University of Nebraska, Lincoln, they did some great work on faculty retention and promotion as part of their NSF Advanced Grant. And that included some good work, insightful work on service as well. The Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, so IUPUI, are also, they're a collaborative between those two universities that does really great work on promotion and tenure, and again, has incorporated some ways of doing evaluating service, to better understanding and evaluating service. The University of Oregon, both their faculty senate, I thought this was great that their faculty senate passed a resolution about service and did some investigative work about it, as well as the University of Oregon convened a task force on university service. I'd like to see more institutions do that as well. And since I'm in the state of Oregon, I'll also mention Oregon State University, their PTI initiative, that's promotion and tenure and innovation and entrepreneurship. Even though that's the focus, I&E, they have done really great work on dealing with reducing bias in promotion and tenure. The Oregon State's advanced grant team also have done great work, similar work in promotion and tenuring and reducing bias.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful list, Donna. And I'm sure it's of great value for those listening to this podcast to be able to hear about those other institutions and people doing this work. So thank you for that. Last question I'd love to ask you, Donna, as we wrap this up. What does the road ahead look like for you in doing this work?
The road ahead. That is a great question. I think that for me, I'm really interested in being able to apply all that I've learned over the past 5 years and seeing others who have done this type of work. I'd love to have an opportunity to chat directly with others who are doing this work too, because I think when you talk about the road ahead, I've mentioned this before at a academic impressions event, that very often we're siloed by our institution. And the road ahead for me is one where there's greater dialogue from one institution and the other, more sharing of information, more opportunities to connect with similar other institutions as well, to have the conversations on what's being done, what worked, what didn't work, what changes are happening. How can we provide feedback when we are at, I'm at an institution that now was classified as an R2 this year, or last academic year, but we still have a 4-4 teaching load. We teach 4 courses per semester. So being able to have some kind of feedback loop to the R1s and the R2s that are producing the faculty, so they're the ones who will be training future faculty, is giving them information and insights about our experiences and the importance of service to our institutions.
Wonderful, Donna. I want to offer a very sincere thank you to you for you being here with us. Your perspective has been not only very insightful and valuable, but I appreciate the approach you've taken with the work and responding to the questions as well. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I love working with Academic Impressions, and I want to tell you, Licia, I appreciate what you and AI is doing, because they're providing the venue very often for what exactly I mentioned, a conversation across institutions.
One quick note before we end this podcast, be sure to mark your calendars for a live Q&A discussion that is a follow-up to this podcast series. All 3 of our guests will be present, and that will take place on September 28th from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern. So with that, thank you for listening, and please enjoy the rest of your day.